G'day, welcome back to English History Fact and Fiction, episode the 193rd. Betty and Mary again, my name's Dick Newman in Australia. It's not fires this year, it's floods. But for Scotty from Marketing and the gang, it's women's issues and the boys are not performing terribly well at all.
Has the criticism of the Prime Minister been too harsh here?
No. The Prime Minister could just not be further from what is going on in this country. I was out at that march, and a lot of Labor figures, and I know some government figures were as well. The power, the anger, the feeling that people's voices are not being heard, that's what the Prime Minister is not acknowledging.
And the same Prime Minister that opened his door.
Are you going to talk over me on this? Are you really going to talk over me on this issue?
The Prime Minister that invited those representatives.
Ben, we're talking about respect for women in this workplace. Are you going to talk over me?
In the land. I think we can have a respectful conversation.
Yeah, it seems the only way we can mansplain things to ladies properly is if we talk over them. So, you know, that's how it is. And to be fair, that's just one of Scotty's henchmen, and Scotty himself had a good old boo-hoo-hoo in Parliament, so we all know that he's the real victim here. Let's circle back. You're probably wondering when I'd get round to Pachelbel's Canon in D major. Have we done it? And it's a recap. It's a story about our three girly power players. Team Betty the Marvellous, Team Mary, Team Queen of Scots, and Catherine de Medici, Mother of the King and Ruler of France. One Protestant, two Catholics, makes three girls, all saying the same thing, oddly enough. Moderation. But does that idea sit well with the boys, who say everybody's got to do it our way? Our way is the right way, so they're not allowed to do it their way. For me, the big swinging dicks give zero fucks about which way anybody does the magic show. It's about power and money. Common smelly types might get sucked into thinking it's all about what baby Jesus wants, and as usual get sucked into doing the fighting and dying for their wealthy overlords. But for me, it's always about money and power. Last election in Australia, I got all these flyers from different people wanting to fight for me. The question I've got is, who are these people they want to fight on my behalf? And why am I so angry that I want these people I don't even know belted up? The true answer, I suspect, is that they want to fight their political opponents on my behalf because that seems to be how governments all over the world now cooperate. We're right, you're wrong, no compromise. That's shit government. In our 21st century, we've managed to compromise on the magical stuff, although it's clear frustrated Christians want it in on the political power. But why should we do the same on politics as we've done on religion, and instead of fighting, get together and just make sensible policy? Mary has got back to Scotland to meet up with John Knox. Oh, the poor girl. He's got zero tolerance for girly kings and zero tolerance for Catholics, and Mary happens to be both. Catherine de Medici is running France and, like Mary, is head of the Catholic faction. She's just passed another bill aimed at moderation and both sides hate it. Betty seems to be doing best because, here in England, policies are backed by a whack of legislation, and at the end of the day, it seems for most English, being English is the absolute number one priority. Catholic or Protestant comes in after that, so while guys are fighting, there's so much legislation that all they can do is pick at things like, should the minister's cocktail frock be fuchsia or mauve? For Betty and Mary, we left it with all eyes looking at France and events there. Betty, like any good ruler, thought she should attempt to intervene between the de Guises and Louis Condé to avoid bloodshed, and we'll send an ambassador. We already know that won't avoid bloodshed at all. The embassy was a total dud, except for the guy we sent. Sir Henry Sidney. Sir Henry was the son of Sir William Sidney of Kent, where the beer is best. Sir William's mum was related to one Charles Brandon, who you know will become Duke of Suffolk and brother-in-law to the mad Welshman Henry VIII. The king will even be godfather to our Sir Henry. He's our guy. He'll be born in 1529, so let's say he's about 32 right now. So Henry will grow up with Prince Ted because his dad had been appointed Prince Ted's tutor, chamberlain and steward. Young Henry and young Prince Ted will be BFFs, with Henry staying by Ted's bedside all through his slow, painful and smelly descent into death. Henry has scored a knighthood and got his first gig as Ambassador of France at 22. He did very well on that gig, so it's off to see if he can talk sense to the wild Scotties lad. So Henry will also do well in picking the right people to friend on Facebook, including mover and shaker William Settle. In keeping with his friending the right people, he will more than friend Mary Dudley, he'll marry her. Somehow, he will come out smelling of roses when John Dudley goes down. Henry will be loyal to the extended Dudley family, offering refuge while shit is going down and heads are coming off. One of the Dudleys, of course, to be helped out by Henry was Robert Dudley. Queen Bloody Mary liked the look of the lad, so Henry would pick to be one of King Phil's English mates. This will go well with Henry naming his more famous firstborn son, Phil. Mary will have him off to Ireland to help out in the surrender and re-grant thingy that may have scored a mention, but may not. Senile dementia, but I don't know. Surrender and re-grant kicked off in 1540 and will go on and on till 1603. The mad Welsh king invented it to get more control. That's what we want. We want to be able to control people. The idea then is to get everyone to surrender their lands to the king, who then re-grants it to them using the English legal system of freehold, and then they can have security in their title. Great. And pay rent to Henry. Not so great. But wait, there's more. Irish have to speak English to get the re-grant, and Irish have to give up the Catholic stuff and become Anglican to get the re-grant. It's a bit like the old Romans and the client king arrangements. Do all this, become Englishified, and I will protect you. It's happening, but it's all very slow. Henry Sidney will get into a bit of biff with the Irish, hard to avoid really, and will get the top job there for about a year while the boss is in England. He will do very well, acting number one in Ireland. Henry though, as you may expect, having been BFF with Teen King Ted, was Protestant, so he will retire from court under Mary. Then comes Betty, and Robert Dudley will return the favour to Henry and get him back in the court. Within a few years, he's got into the Privy Council and is a Gartonite. He's also been appointed as Lord President of Wales, doing very well. The negotiations with France were a dud, so Betty moved on to that deal with the Huguenots. Throckmorton had previously written to Cecil, "Our friends, the Protestants, must be handled and dandled so that, should Spain intervene, they, for their defence, or for desire, or revenge, or affection to the Queen, may be moved to give her possession of Calais, Dieppe, or New Haven, perhaps all three." Now that's what got Sir Henry Sidney off to France to chat with Louis Condé. The Huguenots hold the harbour, what do we call it, New Haven, and Betty wants to garrison it. Once the Huguenots are in total charge of France, they'll swap the harbour for Calais, and Calais can be English territory once more. Off go our brave soldiers under the leadership of Ambrose Dudley, the eldest brother of Robert, and Ambrose is now the Earl of Warwick. It was said, my dear listener, that Ambrose inherited the money while Robert inherited the brains. What say our French allies? This guy has zero experience, and don't you usually send a nice, nasty Duke of Norfolk? Can't we have a Tom Howard type? No. Well, we all hope Ambrose will bring some nice old grizzled captains with him. He will be supported by experienced captains, but he won't have a diplomat like Ralph Sadler with him. To fill that gap, Ambrose will bring some of the more extreme Protestants with him. Guys from the John Knox fan club and the Calvinists that Betty doesn't like. Let's hope he puts them in the front line if there's a battle. Some of these guys were already in Europe with England not particularly wanting them. Yeah, you're too extreme, mate. Betty's instructions were that our men were too valuable to be risked, so avoid battle. It's all about just hanging out in La Havre so we can get Calais back. It does seem that Robert Dudley had a big hand in this, doing lots of letter writing to get these meetings happening, and he'll score rewards. a nice big fat land parcel and licenses to export 80,000 undressed white cloths in a nice big fat monopoly deal. Betty will toss in an annual pension of £1,000 with part of the term saying the Queen's great favour where she has declared him worthy above the rest of men on account of his many excellent virtues and gifts of mind. You would be aware, my dear listener, that my mind is permanently in the gutter. So I'm guessing Robert's mind gift is that his brain could get his tongue moving in a particularly pleasing manner while it was between Betty's thighs. Most girls need a bit of relief here and there. His big brother Ambrose had recently been restored to the Earl of Warwick gig, which included another big fat land parcel with a nice castle, a manor, and the borough of Warwick. The taint of their family name by Naughty Dad from 1553 has been erased. The Dudleys are back as part of the whole court and the courtier scene. Robert is no longer just some exotic outsider who the Queen is hot for. He's an insider who the Queen is hot for. Dudley may be happy, but if we read Cecil's writings, he's a bit gloomy. It's his analysis of Catholics getting the upper hand in France and brooding about Mary Queen of Scots' negotiations to marry insane Don Carlos of Spain. He's pondering getting together with the Lutherans in Germany to get a bit of a holy war going against the cattle ticks. He's thinking about whether England could just hold the Frenchy Catholics up by chatting with them, then costing out German mercenaries to go and help the Huguenots. Cecil is busy writing down numbers and adding them up to see the cost. He's very busy, but we see nothing from him about policy. It looks like Robert Dudley is doing the ideas stuff, pushing the policy, and unlike that previous foray into Scotland, Betty seems all for a stupid foreign war right now. Just mind my brave soldiers and try not to get them hurt. Let's be where we should be. That is 1562, and Henry Sidney has a job to go and tell Mary Queen of Scots that the girls' brunch date has been cancelled. There's been problems like the weather, but really there was no specific reason we can see for Betty cancelling lunch. Speculation time, so here it is. Betty was worried that Mary was beautiful and charming and would charm the pants off the English people who would say, let's have gorgeous, charming Mary instead of ugly Betty. It does seem to be a bit of a flaw in ladies that they look in the mirror and only see imperfections and so lose a bit of confidence, whereas men look in the mirror and just see some ripped Chris Hemsworth type looking back. Betty, though, might have a point in the Catholic types, just like the look of Mary. It was problematic for Mary, too. Her De Guise uncles might not like her having scones and tea with Betty, who's just sent troops to France to support their enemies, the Huguenots. Is it a big deal, though? Meeting of two heads of state generally have just given us two guys pretending to be super friends with all the I love you, man. No, I really love you, man. Then they get into the biff. We'll get to that battle at Rouen, Catholics versus Huguenots, with Betty keeping the bulk of her forces in Le Havre. Just a few going to wave the English flag. A wealthy guy or two taken captive for ransom, and some bravely die in defence of a particular flavour of magic show. Not looking good for the boys in Le Havre, but the Frenchies are back to talking, not killing. That might be nice for our brave soldiers, but it's tricky for us on policy. This is not like Betty's foray into Scotland. This time the religion and the politics don't mesh. A Frenchie may be a Protestant, but the idea of giving Calais back to the English might sit well. And for Betty, it will be how much should she reasonably spend in an effort to get Calais back? Oh, hang on a tick. What's this? It's a marriage proposal from the Duke of Württemberg, a German Protestant prince. Whatever will Betty say? Although she never yet were weary of single and maiden life, yet indeed she was the last issue of a father left, and the only of a house. The care of a kingdom and the love of posterity did counsel her to alter this course of life. But in consideration of the lead that her subjects had given her in ampler manner to make her choice than they did to any prince of four, she was even in courtesy bound to make that choice as so should be for the best of her state and subjects. And for that he offered her therein assistance, she graciously acknowledged the same, promising to deserve it hereafter. The Duke's just been sent to the friend zone. Yeah, I'll have your help, mate, but you won't be getting a marriage back for it. How are our brave soldiers going in Le Havre? Plague. Betty had been resisting pressure to send more guys and spend more money. With the plague, she'll be forced to send replacement troops, but bad weather, so not many will get through. Our man over there, the Earl of Warwick, Ambrose Dudley, will have to surrender and bring his guys home with the plague. Now it's in London, with about 1,000 deaths a week. Parliament will be held in Hertford Castle, and Betty will be staying away at Windsor. Betty will study the writings of the churchy types. That might help her sound like she knows what she's talking about as governess of the English Church. Now, Betty might be doing magic spells, but the council are pondering the Frenchy situation. They'd like to see that the Guises go down, but it worked out that English intervention probably won't do anything. Just like US intervention wherever, it does nothing for the locals and just supports that permanent war economy for them. But for Betty, it's been a total waste of money and men's lives.
And I heard to say I love you when it's so hard for me. And I hate to say I want you when you make it so clear you don't want me. I'd never ask you, 'cause deep down I'm certain I know what you'd say. You'd say, I'm sorry, believe me, I love you, but not in that way.
Yeah, Sam Smith there helping out Betty with some words for the Duke of Wittenberg. I love you, but not in that way. Good news for Robert Dudley. October 1562, he's on the council. Bad news for Robert Dudley is that, so is Tom Howard, Duke of Norfolk. Good news for Robert Dudley, he will soon head a faction. Chief in this will be Henry Killigrew from an old Cornish family. Henry got in a job with John Dudley, our now dead Robert's dad, and became president of the Dudley Fan Club. Got elected to Parliament, got the fuck out of town during the Bloody Mary years, got into a bit of piracy, was at the Battle of St. Quentin, and got shot off his horsey but managed to escape. Betty then called him back when she got in. Most recently, he went into bat for the Happy Clappers at Rouen. Let's all say hi to Henry. We'll hear more about this guy. Despite Robert getting lots and lots of presents and forming a faction, it will be Cecil who has Betty's ear on foreign affairs. Robert is all, let's go overseas and kill fuck tons of Catholics so we can all clap happily together. While Cecil is all, let's just fuck over the English Catholics and stay the fuck out of other countries' problems. Cecil won, which means England won in my book. These two guys then might be the balance of power in court. No hostility between the two lads, but not much in the way of cooperation either. Cecil is a senior public servant, hard-working, he's got great knowledge, discreet, will obey the Queen's decisions. Dudley is becoming a politician, adaptable and useful at public affairs. On policy, they actually aren't that far apart. Both are happy clappers, with Dudley perhaps being a bit further left than Cecil. It's the foreign policy, with Cecil being more of an isolationist to give us maximum autonomy in England. Dudley is in communication with the radicals in Geneva and wants to be an interventionist and likes stuff like expanding the English borders, say to France for starters. If we were to stop and check, though, we'd find that things have gone pretty well so far for Betty. There are no longer Frenchies on the island of Britain, and the old alliance between France and Scotland is gone. Betty's religious policies seem to be the best in Europe. We've stopped burning people, and we aren't at war with each other. The big problem for us is that lack of sperm in Betty's vagina to make an heir to the big chair, which, as you know, my dear listener, is the monarch's job. It's in the job description. Betty managed to survive that bout of smallpox, but it was a big reminder that we do not have an heir to the big chair, and that is very scary for us. How's it going for Mary, Queen of Scots? Well, she is pissed off. She had to call in all the nobles to travel to Edinburgh on the 5th of July 1562, ready for the girls' brunch. Henry Sidney couldn't get there with the message that it's off until the 23rd July. Part of the reason given to Mary was that Betty has unfriended her because we're pissed off that your Uncle Frankie Scarface has been a complete fucker, shooting up a Protestant church for singing baby Jesus songs too loudly. Mary can faint and be off to bed for a few days. That's girly kinks for you. She can then get the good news. You've fainted before the end of the letter, which says Becky hopes we can do cocktails next year, say between May and August. Mary will say, oh, yes, and a date is set for the 20th of June, 1563. Should we have some gossip? I think so. If you've seen a Mary Queen of Scots movie, then it will feature Lord Bothwell as a protagonist. He doesn't seem to play well with the other nobles and may also get a hard-on when Mary walks into a room. Now, you might recall the young Earl of Arran, James Hamilton, had proposed to Betty and got a fast swipe left. Then he proposed to Mary, who likewise swiped left. We think that for Arran, Betty was the better prospect, but Mary was the hottie for him. This could be because Mary was pretty charming. She can do the chat and crack the jokes, and she may look a bit free and easy, which she's not. She's just a bit, and only a bit, of a flirt. Our other men in this little tale would be one of Mary's uncles who is hanging out in Scotland, the Marquis of Elmworth, together with Mary's half-brother, John Stuart. Yeah, that's John, not the previously introduced James. And the last one in this tale is James Hepburn, the Earl of Bothwell. Arran had a hot chick to perhaps help release built-up male tension, one Alison Craik. Now, three naughty nobles will force their way into Alison's dad's house. It was pissed boys behaving badly, but we'll have the Protestants all chanting, Elmworth must go, get him out of Scotland. Mary will tell John Stuart and Lord Bothwell they've been very naughty, and they should say sorry and promise never to do it again. No way, they say, it's just a bit of fun and we'll probably do it again. At least they're honest. The Arran mob will form up with blunt and sharp objects of pain and head on over to Bothwell's place. Bothwell got the news that they were coming, so got his gang together. Fortunately, James Stuart also heard about it and rode on in telling them all to go home or else, and a little battle in Edinburgh was averted. Mary will call Arran and Bothwell in for a little chat, with Arran bringing some Protestants and Bothwell bringing some Catholics. Bothwell will smartly withdraw to avoid another unpleasant scene. Now, Arran will shortly have one of his bouts of insanity, but when he comes back to his senses, Mary will do a bang-up job of getting Bothwell to send a friend request to Arran, but it will actually take John Knox to get Arran to accept it. If that seems a bit weird that Knox was trying to make friends with a Catholic, then the Knox family had been the feudal dependents of Bothwell, so in this case religion doesn't get in the way. Well, at last, no, young Arran will go mad again and decide there's a plot between his dad and Bothwell to kidnap Mary and kill James Stuart and Maitland. He will yell it until both Bothwell and his dad are brought in for a chat. At that time, he'll change his mind, so it's not my dad, just Bothwell. And Mary can thank me for exposing this filthy plot by marrying me. The council will determine that young Arran needs to be locked up for his own good. Bothwell, though, will admit that he had daydreamed about kidnapping the young hot queen, so he'll be off to the slammer, full daydreaming. He'll escape a few months later. Young Arran will not escape spending the rest of his long life in custody. Old Arran, his dad, will boo-hoo-hoo. His dynasty is fucked, as is he. He shouldn't trouble us again in this podcast, I don't think. I'm pretty sure. We'll see. The Hamiltons' father and son are gone, and they were the number one family after Mary, so somebody else will have to step in. Next senior family are the Gordons, who will be as much of a threat to peace as the Hamiltons had been, except that they're Catholics, while Lord Arran, Hamiltons, were happy clappers. Godfather of the Gordon clan was Don George. No, just George. No Dons in Scotland. He was a grandson of Dad Killer King Jim IV, and so is a cousin to Mary. He is known for being a total dick hard man, unreliable, devious, double-dealing, with some behaviour being pretty treasonous. George hates long walks along the beach at sunset, and also hates James Stuart. Mary, though, will call in the council to talk to them about a request from Betty for Scotty Hardmen to go and support the Huguenots. John Knox, of course, is all for it. Yeah, let's go and help the Huguenots. Here's the problem, though, which you might be thinking is just that Mary would be sending troops to oppose her uncle Frankie Scarface. And fair call on your part, but of course it's worse. The guy that the Scotties would send would be George Gordon, 4th Earl of Huntly, who is not only Catholic, he's pissed off with Mary. He was the Earl of Huntly and the Earl of Moray, but Mary gave the Earldom of Moray to James Stuart, and George is very cross. Mary will be out and about and will meet up with George's Mrs. Elizabeth, who will ask her to intervene in the case of her naughty son, Sir John Gordon. He's on the run for the fuzz, John is. Mary will say, sure, tell him to present himself to the authorities, which he'll do. They'll say you need to go under kind of self-custody at Stirling in 7 days' time, which he will not do. Mary will issue an arrest warrant and head on over to her castle at Inverness. Now, the keeper of her castle at Inverness is one of the extended Gordon family, Alexander Gordon, and he'll say, you can't come in, Mary. Oh, fuck, that's treason. The mob will hear about it, rush on in, get the place open, and Alexander will be hanged. Mary will then head on over to Spinney to see Patrick Hepburn, Catholic Bishop of Moray and great-uncle to Lord Bothwell. He'd been mates with the Catholic Gordons, but will go over to Mary and a Protestant half-brother, James Stuart. Mary will increase the size of her entourage, and just as well. Now, on the run, Sir James Gordon will harass the flanks of her baggage train over and over. That's not going well. 27th of June, 1562, Sir John Gordon will wound Lord Ogilvy in Airlie in a brawl, and he's off to the slammer. Sir John had been banging Lord Ogilvy's stepmum, managed to rob Ogilvy of his inheritance, and for good measure tossed Ogilvy's floozy in the slammer. Now, Gordon will escape the slammer again. Mary will feel the need to connect her boot to the nuts of a Gordon or two. She'll be off for a little chat, taking plenty of hard men. There'll be plenty of posturing and chat, with George being full of shit and managing to escape Mary. The council will give him 24 hours to turn himself in or be declared an outlaw. George Gordon will organise an army of around 1,000 guys and march on Mary at Aberdeen to apprehend the Queen and to do with the rest at his will. His guys will wear a bit of heather in their caps to show they are with Gordon. And as we go merrily down the road, fewer and fewer guys will stay, with smart ones sneaking back home for a nice bowl of hot porridge. 27th of October, the rebels will camp at the Hill of Fair at Corrichie. Next day, the rather overweight and non-fit Gordon won't get out of bed till 10 a.m, lazy bucker. He'll look out of the tent and say, oh, fuck it, there's a big mob of Mary's hard men. Time for George to get God on side. Oh, Lord, I have been a bloodthirsty man, and by my means has much innocent blood been spilled. But wilt thou give me victory this day, and I shall serve thee all the days of my life. God will say, no. George actually got himself into a good position, top of the hill, so he can attack any side. So long as lots of Mary's guys defect for some hot porridge, he will do well. But no, Mary has him surrounded, and her guys have harquebuses and start picking off George's guys. Lots of George's guys will start running away, so the cavalry can have fun chasing them down for a bit of kill, kill, kill. We'll have about 200 of George's guys killed and 120 captured, including George. What sort of death would you give George, my dear listener? Surely a nice clean beheading. But no, no need. George will go red in the face with anger, have a stroke, and he's off to the Heavenly Bagpipe Choir. Sir John Gordon and his brother Adam were also captured. George's body was preserved because Scotty tradition says his corpse needs to attend Parliament to face charges of treason. Then we can pass the Bill of Attainder, and then we can take his stuff. Lovely. Sir John will cop the death penalty with a nice beheading, except the axe man is a dick. Plenty of wax required to get John Gordon's head off, and Mary can faint again. His younger brother, Adam, being only 17, will score a presidential pardon. He will be the star in a poem, Edam O' Gordon. I'm not reading it to you, it's too long and it's very nasty. He will fight for Mary in the future. George's eldest lad, George Jr., seemed to have had no involvement, but he will be put on trial and sentenced to a hung, drawn and quartering. But Mary will swap that for time in the summer. He will also fight for Mary in the future. Internationally, Mary is in the shit with the Pope and King Phil. They see her as being a bit of a traitor to the true faith. Mary will write and say, No, I'm a very good Catholic and was just dealing with a rebellious noble. Just to prove it, I will make Scotland Catholic again. Really? Have you thought this through, Mary? Worse, Mary will now hear that Betty's guys are fighting against her De Guise relatives. Worse, Mary and her top team, James Stewart and Maitland, will meet the new acquaintance. That's the Scotty name for this new fangled influenza thing. The same thing that is still hanging around and mutating and killing humans every year, even now. But back then, it was new. Now, Betty will also hit the big 3-0. And to celebrate this, some sort of image has been produced, which we might call a caricature or something like it. Betty is not best pleased with that, so Cecil will issue a proclamation. For as much as though the natural desire that all sorts of subjects had to procure the portrait and likeness of the Queen's Majesty, great numbers of painters and some printers and gravers had and did daily attempt in diverse manners to make portraitures of her, wherein none hitherto had sufficiently expressed the natural representation of Her Majesty's person, favour or grace, but had for the most part erred therein, whereof daily complaints were made among her loving subjects, that for the redress hereof Her Majesty had been so importunately sued unto by the lords of her council and other of her nobility, not only to be content that some special cunning painter might be permitted by access to Her Majesty to take the natural representation to her, whereas she has been always of her own right disposition very unwilling, but also to prohibit all manner of other persons to draw, paint, grave or portrait her personage or visage from time to time, until there were some perfect pattern or example to be followed. Yeah, so Cecil is saying it's going to be the official portrait only. Nobody else can do one. And fair enough, I think. You've got to control your image, haven't you? Therefore, Her Majesty being herein, as it were, overcome with the continual requests of so many of her nobility and lords, whom she could not well deny, was pleased that some cunning person should shortly make a portrait of her personal visage to be participated to others for the comfort of her loving subjects, and furthermore commanded that till this should be finished, all other persons should abstain from making any representations of her, that afterwards Her Majesty would be content that all other painters, printers or gravers, that should be known men of understanding, and so therein licensed by the head officers of the place where they should dwell, as reason it was that every person should not without consideration attempt the same, might at their pleasure follow the said pattern or first portraiture, and for that Her Majesty perceived a great number of her loving subjects to be much grieved with the errors and deformities herein committed, she straightly charged her officers and ministers to see the observation of this proclamation, and in the meantime to forbid the showing or publication of such as were apparently deformed until they should be reformed, which were reformable. Oh, my giddy aunt, my dear listener, they can't get a simple message out, can they? So Betty's saying, yeah, she'll get some official portraits done because all the nobles want a portrait of her. Of course, that's what they want. They want a picture of their darling Betty in their house. So she'll be getting tons of portraits done, and then she can get some official painters or cunning men. Cunning means talented or skilled or something, artisan. So the cunning painter can do some copies, and then the printers can publish them. Sounds all right. Sadly, though, Betty will score smallpox, which won't kill her, but it will come close, and that girlish complexion may now be replaced by a pox-scarred face, which may be why we now start to see her with perhaps a tad too much makeup on in her portraits. The council had to make the important decisions without her while she was under the influence of the dreaded pox. One matter close to their hearts was the succession thing, and that's pissing Mary off. She needs to know, and she would surely like Betty to stop interfering in France. Mary has to be on Team de Guise because those uncles control her dowry and she needs the cash. In England, the council members talking about succession are torn between Margaret Douglas, Countess of Lennox, niece of Henry VIII, and Mary Queen of Scots, who is great-niece of Henry VIII. The discussion is around Margaret Douglas being devout and sensible, which implies that Mary is neither devout nor sensible. Mary, then, is now not trusted by Catholics and despised by Protestants like John Knox. Knox is bothered that even if Mary turned Protestant, she would not submit to his iron-willed, churchy bullshit. Fair enough if he bags it just for being a girl. I can see a future where, if Mary even turned Protestant, it would be an Anglican Protestant to align with Betty and not his more radical Presbyterian religion. He will bag Mary in sermons, saying, "She dances! Worse, she danced until midnight. Worse and worse, she danced at the beginning of the persecution of the Huguenots, clearly showing that she was happy that Protestants were being killed." Well, that last one is partially true, because she did celebrate the Catholics taking over Rouen again. Mary will have him in for a little chat and tell him she gets that he doesn't like her uncles, but if he's not happy with her, he should come in and complain, and not just go bullshitting off to his congregation, but come to her. She'll give him a fair hearing. "Yeah, nah," says Knox, "I'd rather air your dirty laundry in public, so perhaps it should be you attending my sermons, and you can hear me bag you first hand, rather than you getting it second hand. What a total turd. Besides, Mary, I'm a busy man working on a magic book. I haven't got time to turn up here every time you're upset about some little thing." Mary just turned her back on him and walked off. Everybody's friend, baby Jesus. Trouble is, he just takes sides sometimes. Now, something's gone pear-shaped with Mary's dowry. If there ain't no cash, then there ain't no love. French ambassadors will turn up to try and kiss and make up and say, "Hey, Mary, we've got that hunky Duke of Anjou looking your way." This will be Catherine de' Medici and Henri's youngest lad, Frankie. Let's see. His face was scarred by smallpox and he's got a deformed spine. Named Hercule when he was born, but this is no Hercules, so they changed it to Frankie. He's nicely rich, though. Betty will hear about that, and she will not be happy. He's only got two older brothers, with the eldest being rather sickly and a bit insane between him and the big Frenchy chair. Betty will send a couple of senior hard men into the north to be in charge there, put the frightness on the Scotties a bit, and they're to tell her Scotty ambassador Randolph that he needs to knock this marriage proposal on the head. The garrison at Berwick will be ramped up, and it looks a little bit like England's getting on a war footing. Randolph is to tell Mary that she needs to marry someone who is British and not European, and if she does Becky this one tiny little favour, then Mary might find herself back in the list of succession. And tell Mary that, in fact, she can marry Robert Dudley with his tight arse and lovely legs. Yeah, lady, see, he might have a tight arse and lovely legs, but he's a bit of a nobody for nobility. Son of a traitor, brother of an earl, that's about it. It might be an insult to Mary. Mary isn't too fussed, so we'll get the "I'll think about it" answer. Meanwhile, the Catherine Grey fan club has been writing books and documents saying what a great queen she would be. Writer-in-chief John Harles will find himself in the slammer, Fleet Prison. Cecil was ordered to get the names. Not a nice task, because one name would be his brother-in-law, Nicholas Bacon, and Cecil knows it. Cecil himself might even be implicated. But Cecil, of course, will take on the task. Hales will do 6 months in the slammer. Bacon will be told just to stick to his official duties and forget about Catherine Grey. Catherine's uncle, Lord John Grey, will go under house arrest for life, which is only a few months. That's all. He's going to die in a few months. With no heads coming off, people aren't sure if Betty was fair dinkum upset by the whole thing, or just acting out. Tom Seymour, Catherine Grey's secret husband that everybody knows about, will get the ecclesiastical court to declare his kiddies legit, and not even Betty can interfere with that churchy stuff. April 1564, Treaty of Troyes. We want to be okay with France again, and this treaty will suggest a nice bit of peace for 5 years. It wouldn't matter, really, because both France and Spain have got their own problems at the moment. They've got no time to worry about England. But with nothing doing in foreign policy, we can just think about royal weddings. Both Betty and Mary, with the council saying, "When are you getting married?" over and over and over to Betty. Fair enough, if we break back into civil war, then this time religion would also be involved, and that could go really, really pear-shaped. Betty's looking pretty serious about this Virgin Queen business, and the only guy on the horizon for her is Robert Dudley. And apart from Robert Dudley and his three mates, nobody wants that marriage. Betty may have offered him to Mary, but we won't be fooled there. Of course Mary wouldn't be taking that noble nobody. And oh, Betty's just made him Earl of Leicester. Okay. An anti-Dudley faction will form. Cecil will quietly be on their team. Now these guys will be pushing for Archduke Charles of Austria as marriage material, so Dudley certainly knows he's got a position. Now let's give Betty an outing to Cambridge to visit the uni. Off she goes to King's College Chapel, that very chapel that booted my dear old kiddie dad from his organ apprenticeship for playing the boogie-woogie on the organ. The Chancellor will kneel to make the welcome statement, "Nonis veritas et utinum," and on for half an hour. Fuck, half an hour you got to put up with that. It's all about how great Betty's virginity is. Yes, it's a marvellous thing. Betty will say thanks, then she can get in the door finally and hear the Te Deum and have a nice happy clapper full ceremony. Next day, it's Sunday, so back to the chapel, and we're going to have a play in a chapel. Yeah, they did that back then. It was okay. Olaria by Portus, the Roman guy. We don't really know the full play, only part of it survived. It is about a miser, though, and that's a stock-in-trade character for playwrights. Day three and four, more plays. Then it's off to the colleges to get nice presents and orations and books. Betty has had a nice little holiday, so it will get to her farewell speech. Betty will be all coy about making the speech in Latin, Latin being the language of the unis. She will suggest that the Chancellor speak on her behalf because he's, well, he's the Chancellor. And the Chancellor is the Queen's mouth. "No," he says, "look, I'm not your Chancellor, I'm the uni's Chancellor." Bishop of Ely will kneel and beg, "Just three words out of your magnificent God would be enough." "Oh, all right," says Betty, "even though I haven't prepared a fancy speech." Now, that's probably true. The fancy speech had probably been prepared by Cecil. Off she goes with a flowery speech, and I might say a long speech. "I may still be able to execute some distinguished undertaking, and never will I be diverted from the intention while life shall animate this frame. Should it, however, happen, as it may, I know not how soon that I should be overtaken by death before I have been able to perform this my promise. I will not fail to leave some great work to be executed after my decease, by which my memory may be rendered famous, others excited by my example, and all of you animated to greater ardour in your studies." Yeah, lots of that sort of stuff, and it's vague promises about how Betty will make unis great again by big fat injections of cash, and if she can't do it while she's alive, she'll make sure it happens after she's died. And neither of those will actually happen. Betty is way more like her granddad, Henry VII, who was very good at getting the cash in and very reluctant to send the cash out. Betty will be frugal. Maybe not in the handing stuff to Robert Dudley, but everyone has to let a bit of stuff out. So instead of sending dollars to the unis, this is where Robert gets made an earl in an elaborate ceremony of magnificence, and he scores Kenilworth Castle. Oh, and it's another marriage proposal brought to us by a Scotty, Sir James Melville. He's a second-rank diplomat, and at this time, well, when I say this time, I'm talking about Betty's time and our time, that means he's a bit of a spy type. That's what you do with your spies, you make them second-rank diplomats. His family had worked for Mary of Guise, and Sir James had been sent to France as a kiddie with Mary, Queen of Scots. Brought up by Monluc, Bishop of Valence, who seems to be one of those bishops who was not into the kiddie fiddling, but into raising kiddies to be spies. Part of Sir James' current chores has been carting around portraits of inbred nobles with attached wedding proposals. That brings him to Betty with a portrait of Duke Casimir, another German type. Melville will wax lyrical about the Duke of Casimir. Betty will see his portrait and just swipe left. Betty will send Melville on his merry matchmaking way to Mary with the word that Mary should marry Robert Dudley, and Mary will fire back a rather sharp tweet. No more happy letters between the two girls for a while. Mary, though, will want to re-establish relationships and send Melville into England once more to chat with Betty, the Spanish ambassador, and the Lady Margaret Douglas. Neither England nor Scotland are looking for any hostilities, so when Melville turns up, we all pretend everything's fine and dandy. And ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, pretending everything is fine and dandy can often work. We turned our imagined world into a real world. Melville then gets asked by Betty what Mary thought about marrying Robert Dudley. He'll say Mary is chatting to her top guys, and all she can think about at the moment is peace and happiness for both England and Scotland. Betty will say, hey, I know Robert's a bit common, but stick around, I'm about to make him a senior earl. We do have some writings from Melville. The problem is that he's a spook, so it's hard to rely on them. But here's a passage about Betty being a girly type. She desired to know of me what colour of hair was reputed best, and whether my queen's hair or hers was best, and which of the two of them was fairest. I answered the fairness of them both was not their worst faults, but she was earnest with me to declare which of them I judged fairest. I said she was fairest in England and mine in Scotland. Yet she appeared earnest. I answered they were both the fairest ladies in their countries, that Her Majesty was whiter, but my queen was very lovely. She inquired which of them was the highest stature. I said, my queen. Then she saith, she is too high. For I myself am neither too high nor too low. Yeah, he goes on with Betty asking those totally fucking tricky questions. Which one of us is better looking? And I think Melville has given we boys types a bit of a masterclass in handling those. The Earl of Lennox, Matthew Stewart, will be wanting to go to Scotland, where a bill of attainder had previously been passed against him. Mary has decided that she will reverse it, so of course Matthew wants to go. So does his boy, Henry Stewart, Lord Darnley. He's about 20 and terribly pretty, and surely Betty knows he will try for a quick kiss behind the gardener's shed with Mary. Betty, though, will give him permission to go. Mary, of course, has always been just as interested in Betty's marriage as her own. But Betty, 8 years older than Mary, is, sorry, well and truly in old maid territory for the times, and it's looking unlikely that she will ever marry. Spring 1563, and Maitland was preparing to head to England to argue Mary's case for being in the succession, when Mary perhaps had the first of a series of unfortunate events.
Look away, look away, look away, look away. Show will wreck your evening, your whole life and your day. Every single episode is nothing but dismay. So look away, look away, look away.
Yeah, marvellous little series of books, that wasn't it? The series of unfortunate events that I got to read to my youngest, I think. I enjoyed them. Meet the poet Pierre de Boscatel de Chatelard. He had impeccable aristocratic connections on his mum's side, from the Chevalier Bayard. He was highly accomplished, a good musician, a wannabe poet. When he looks in the mirror, he sees a total chick magnet staring back. He's in the court of the Queen, which will make his poetry all about how hot Mary is. Mary will write the odd poem in response. He had returned to France, but November 1562, he was back in Scotland to deliver a letter to Mary from his boss, Sieur Damville, younger son of the Constable of France, Montmorency. Whatever was in the letter made Mary smile. On his way to Scotland, Chatelard had been in London telling people that he was on his way to see his lady love. Then Mary, seeing him again, gave him some cash for fancy outfits and was her usual over-friendly self. English ambassador can tell us how our nobles feel about that. Mary had been unduly familiar with so unworthy a creature, an abject of varlet, a familiarity too much to have been used to his master himself by any princess alive. You see, Mary's a bit of a flirt, and I'm sure for Mary it's the courtly love stuff, but guys find it difficult to determine a boundary in that stuff. And sadly, we have to look to the writings of John Knox to help get the story on this. He's already got Mary as a filthy idolater and a filthier girly type, so a transition to fornicator will be all too easy for John Knox. He's looking for a scandal, and of course it's easy to combine fact and speculation. Was Meghan Markle totally awful to the poor, hard-working, common-type servants in the palace? Or was it totally awful Prince Charles being racist? Who cares? They're both filthy rich and both are humans. All humans have flaws. The problem also goes to Chatelard being besotted with the Queen, who is paying attention to him. She's being nice while he's reading it as being in love with him. He will sneak into Mary's bedroom one night and hide under a bed. Oh dear, look, gentlemen, never do that, never, ever. He will be discovered by two guys whose very job it was to go and check the bedroom to see if anybody was hiding in there. Oh dear, oh dear. Mary is told the next morning and banished Chatelard. Well done. Almost. Mary should have also given him a kick in the nuts so that he got the message, but he has not received any such message. Dickhead Chatelard will once again manage to get himself into Mary's bedroom, and just as she was about to go to bed, he'll leap out and say, "Surprise!" Mary will scream. Now, he will say that he was just there to apologise, but leaping out in a woman's bedroom is not a good way to go about that. You could just write to her, you dick. Okay, Mary screamed, in comes James Stewart, dagger drawn, ready to kill. But a quick knife to the throat is insufficient punishment. He wants to go through the due process for a nasty execution. Now, the John Knox version is that Mary ordered James to kill the poet there and then, with James on his knees begging Mary not to make him do it. John Knox will even quote them both, even though he was nowhere near the place. Your Grace has intruded him before that you have offended all your nobility, and if he shall be secretly slain at your own command, what shall the world judge of it? I shall bring him to the presence of a justice and let him suffer by the law according to his deserving. Oh, said the Queen, you'll never let him speak. I shall do, said he. Madam, what in me lies to save your honour? Yeah, so Knox has got it that Mary wants this guy silenced, permanently, knife to the throat, that's what she wants. Chatelard will be off to face justice, be convicted and hanged, saying, adieu, the most beautiful and cruel princess in the world. Oh, I forgot the torture first, so he can confess that he was a Huguenot that had been sent in to compromise Mary. The instigator of the plot was Madame de Curasot, codenamed for the Mrs. of Admiral Coligny, leader of the Huguenots. Mary will sleep with Mary Fleming in a bed after all that. Mary, as you should expect by now, was terribly upset by all this, and then 3 weeks later comes the news that Uncle Frankie Scarface is dead. Died 2 days after Chatelard. And that will be followed up by another de Guise uncle, also a Frankie. Yeah, two Frankies. Dying shortly after. Betty will write her a nice condolence letter, and Mary can boo-hoo-hoo to the Ambassador Randolph that she's got no friends at all in the world. At all, none. Randolph will say, "Ah, oh, Betty is your friend, if you just reach out to her." Mary, though, has lost a power player in Frankie Scarface, so wants to boost her power levels. Time for Maitland to reopen talks with Spain about, marrying Don Carlos, oh dear me. He thinks that Mary would never, ever, ever marry either a Protestant or an Englishman, like Robert Dudley. Further, he thinks that if he could get a commitment from insane sadist Don Carlos, then that would force Betty into putting Mary back in the succession. Yeah, maybe. He's keeping it top secret from Betty, so he might be full of shit. What it may really be about is getting Mary out of Scotland and into Spain so James Stewart can get a nice regency job. Maitland will get word that Charles the Cardinal, Mary de Guise's uncle, is back in talks with Archduke Charles of Austria. Maitland will write saying, stay the fuck out. Marriage with a Protestant guy would be terrible for Scotland. He's probably right on that. Mary needs a strong guy to uphold the title in Scotland and force England into the succession thing. Or if Betty should die without naming an heir, a guy capable of taking an army into England to force Mary onto the big chair. Cardinal Charles is looking out for France, so he doesn't want Mary to marry Spain, and neither does Catherine de Medici. Catherine wants Frenchy influence back into Scotland, but isn't prepared to let Mary marry Kitty King Charles, which would make the de Guises powerful again. On that basis, she too is backing Archduke Charles, and that will put Mary off the guy. Scotty say we'll go and do the chat with Austria to keep Betty guessing. Spanish negotiations will stall, so Maitland will be talking nice and loud about a Frenchy marriage. It's all Kitty King Charles will be in his full power in a couple of years, and then the marriage can go ahead. Spanish ambassador will send an urgent dispatch to King Phil, who will just say he supports the Austrian marriage. At least you, my dear listener, can marry whoever the fuck you want without all this political bullshit. Betty is a bit alarmed and doing the carrot and stick messaging. Maitland will use that to try and play off Phil against Betty. That will work and Phil will reopen talks, but his ambassador will cop the plague and die. Now it seems that it was the ambassador pushing the whole thing, so Phil will cool off again. The replacement ambassador will be just thwarted by Cardinal Charles and Catherine de Medici. The Pope was in favour of Don Carlos, who is about to become even more unwell, and Phil is working out that this kid will not be up to the big chair job. The Pope will switch support to Archduke Charles. The Spanish marriage is now definitely off, and for Mary it was the Pope and Cardinal Charles who ruined her one chance at true happiness with a deformed, insane sadist. She is not a happy Catholic. With no French or Spanish marriage, Mary is on a pat Malone against John Knox and Betty. John Knox, of course, is also not happy. The estates will be called for a talk fest, and in they come wearing, oh no, bright clothes. And their ladies have got nice fashionable frocks. Oh, that's no good. As for Mary, Knox will tell us, the first day she made a painted orison, and there might have been heard amongst her flatterers, Vox Diana, the voice of a goddess, for it could not be day and not of a woman. God save that sweet face. Was there ever an orator spoke so properly and so sweetly? Yeah, it's very sad for John Knox, but we, my dear listener, are sadly out of time once again. Yeah, just a little bit of Mick Ronson there, working hard for David Bowie to get us into some historical fiction. And this week I had a look at a 2003 made-for-TV thing, Henry VIII. It goes for about 3 hours, I guess. And, yeah, well, trying to do too much in 3 hours is what they did. They wanted to do all six wives in 3 hours. Stars Ray Winston as Henry, which I thought, oh, crikey, Ray Winston as Henry. I was expecting them to say something like, oi, Charlie Brandon, do us a solid, take Tommy Howard, nip over to France and snub out that Frankie Big Nose, will you? But there's no Charles Brandon in this. We've got Tom Howard. The other stars, you've got Charles Dance turns up as the Duke of Buckingham. I think that's more about shock value because, you know, he's a big name actor and he's the Duke of Buckingham, so he's going to get killed pretty quickly, head off by Henry. In this one, they torture him first. I'm thinking, no, you don't torture fucking nobles. What are you doing this for? Now, apart from that, really, the standout is Anne Boleyn. She gets the best lines, and she's also Helena Bonham Carter. You, my dear listener, know I've got a little bit of a thing about Helena Bonham Carter, don't you? Yeah. So very pleasant to see her in it. But really, the history's not there much at all. You do get Sean Bean turning up as a Robert Ask in the Rebellion. They change him from a lawyer to a hard man. Yeah. Look, it's not very satisfying, but if you're bored, if it's raining bucket loans for you, like it is for me, then get into it. But for us, it's a matter of what we go out with. So there's this American guy, Eric Whitney, calls himself Ghost Domain, and I'm not totally convinced. I'm just on the fence at the moment, but I thought you might as well have a crack, my dear listener. So let's go out with a bit of Ghost Domain, and he did put out a track called John D, and John D will be entering our story on, I don't know, soon. So let's try that. Hope to see you next week. Bye.
I'm a killer, I'm a